thank you for the introduction. So bear with me. but I'll basically be talking about the search for echoes after the binary neutron star merger, GW-70.
You can put that in your pocket.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's also a clip.
Yeah, that's also a clip.
I do it.
Just put it in your pocket.
Okay. All right. So I'll be talking about the event itself and a little bit of its properties, as well as the search for echoes after the event, and then finishing with sort of what the next steps are concerning the event. So this merger was a binary neutron star merger that occurred on August 17th, 2017. It was detected by the LIGO interferometers. However, there's only a clear signal in the Hanford and Livingston detectors, given that it's sort of out of Virgo's range, and the direction that it came from didn't make for Virgo picking up the signal. So in the search for echoes later on, we only use those two detectors. But the interesting about this event is not only at the time was it the strongest event recorded, there was also a gamma ray burst detected 1.7 seconds after the merger by the Fermi gamma ray observer, as well as electromagnetic detection, which allowed us to very accurately determine where it is in the sky, as well as a couple other things. So that's very interesting. We were able to find out the distance to within a couple of megaparsecs. So with a binary neutron star merger, there's a couple of options for what happens to the remnant. So first is, depending on all the parameters of the event, it could immediately collapse into a black hole. It could form a hypermassive neutron star and collapse into a black hole within 1 second of the event. It could form a supermassive neutron star and collapse within 10 to 10 to 4 seconds after the event, or it could form a stable neutron star. So with this event, there was, by the LIGO collaboration, there was not any gravitational signals detected after the event that would lend some information about whether we would, which of these outcomes happened in the case of this event. The gamma ray burst earlier, as well as a couple other detections, does give us a little bit of information. The mass the mass of the system that was calculated to within a certain degree of accuracy sort of makes it reasonable to assume that we can make the assumption that scenario two is the correct one.
I think the size of the mass is slightly different.
Yes.
Do you know actually how massive Gargantua?
Oh, I don't remember.
Does anybody know?
In this case, it for a very short period, it would form a star that is prevented from collapsing by differential rotation and by a couple different things. But then as that breaks and as that slows down, then it collapses into a black hole. And from that black hole remnant, we can then potentially see the echoes. So there were a couple of different things that pointed towards that scenario. So not only is the mass reasonable, but there was the gamma ray burst about 1.7 seconds after the merger that could also point towards that, as well as lanthanide core ejecta that points to having a hypermassive neutron star for a short period of time after the merger. And so when we take all these parameters into account, like Gil et al. Have done here, we can point to a collapse into the black hole after about 0.98 seconds after the event. So this can this then informs our search for echoes later on.
Although I should say the Strasser echoes preceded this paper.
So. Oh, but yeah, so this is sort of informs our interpretation of it then.
You mentioned the hypermassive case of less than a second. So this is on the long end of that range?
Yes. Yes.
And how low does the range go?
I'm not quite sure, actually.
I mean, astrophysics, things are kind of always very rough. Yeah, so you never, if you said 1 second, it could be 5 seconds. There are lots of mysteries in astrophysics that are really just because these are very rough.
So post this event, Judd and Niyesh did is sort of looking at the echoes, not in terms of models, because that introduces sort of confusion, whether depending on which model you use. What they did is they approximated the echoes as just sort of impulses, repeating impulses over time, over frequency with different harmonics. While it's an approximation, it's due to Lygos sensitivity. It's an all right approximation because we can't actually resolve the individual structure of the echoes, and they remain in approximately the same amplitude over time. So it's good enough.
Do you need more of the absolute value of the pitch?
I would assume so.
Yeah, that's the actual search is that. So this is like a little bit too naive for that. Those are the formulas from our paper, but they were too naive. So I think indeed, so what we really do is that we assume that there's an arbitrary coefficient in front of those delta t's that are independent phases from harmonic to harmonic, but similar.
So taking into account that approximation, they then define a search as follows. Taking into account the parameters of the event, they determined a range in the time delay of the echo after the collapse of the black hole that then translates to sort of a frequency range that we can look in. So searching through that frequency range and searching through a time range that was the same time range that the LIGO collaboration looked for gravitational wave signals from the remnant, and then later found to be consistent with the other paper that cited the black hole collapse within a second. Taking the strain data from the Hanford and Livingston detectors, it was then Rehner filtered, which sort of comparing to a whitening filter that the LIGO collaboration uses in some of its documentation. The whitening filter divides by the amplitude spectral density, whereas they modify the Rehner filter divide by the power spectral density, which is the square of that, in order to sort of optimize the strain for combining over harmonic frequencies, which they do later. What's also important to note is a 2.62 millisecond time delay, which was determined sort of by cross-correlating detectors looking at the signal, due to the fact that the Hanford and Livingston detectors are not in the same physical place. So there was that time delay between the two that was important to take into account for the cross-correlation. So those, the two strains were filtered in that way, and then they found the spectrogram, so the power spectrum of each strain, and that was then used to cross-correlate the two strains. So those power spectra were cross-correlated over 10 harmonics, which seems like a smallish range, but past that point, the frequencies get too high for the LIGO sensitivity.
With harmonics, you mean just the frequencies in time that are measured in each spectrum?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So in that paper, this is the measure that was used, the cross-correlation, in order to sort of identify any echoes, if there be any. So what they did find was an echo, a peak at about 72 hertz, about 1 second after the merger, consistent with their ranges in frequency and in time. And if you see, this is the spectrogram formed by the cross-correlation. You can see the in spiral added over all the harmonics, and then you can see an echo at each harmonic at about 1 second, as well as a fainter one up at about, I believe it was 32 seconds. So pretty exciting. And then taking it over time at about 72 hertz, as found in the spectrogram, these are plots showing the time, and they determined that it could be signal up to about 4.2 sigma. It does have to be, as you can see, they do manifest in peaks in negative X. This is because of a phase difference between the two detectors, LIGO and Hanford. It was approximated in this paper to be about phi, so they're about oppositely oriented, and so then it, pi, sorry. So they're oppositely oriented, so they sort of show up in the negative X, which is something that I'll touch on a little bit later. And then you can also see a spike in the frequency. This is fixed at 1 second, as well as 32 seconds after the merger, we can see the two echoes. So that, and then also determined to about to 4.2 sigma. So this is sort of the process that was gone through. It's a simple method, but in that it's a bit robust in that way. So the next thing then to worry about is that phase difference. So while it was accounted for in the peaks in the negative direction, the phase difference between the two detectors is not necessarily high. It's a little bit different. So what we've been looking at is different measures that could possibly account for that phase difference, and then looking to see if that makes the signal more significant. So here we have the original measure that was used, as well as we have two different measures that potentially that account for the phase difference that sort of based in different ideas. So this one based in the fact that there's a phase difference, but it's, I believe, same across, that was the same one?
Yeah, it's basically the same as first one, it's just we're including the autocorrelation for the power spectra as well.
Right? Yeah. So these two measures sort of taking into account how phase difference between the two detectors. And you can see sort of derivation of that. So as we saw earlier, with the measures, you could either assume that the phase is constant along the harmonics, or you could assume that it is different. We're sort of playing with the different measures of that. And so we can see that, so this is with a time delay of 2.62 milliseconds, this is the original results What I've been doing is mainly learning and trying to reproduce the results of the paper. So we can see a spike at 72 and echoes along the spectrogram. And then if we look at the other measures, we can sort of try and determine significance. We can see a spike also at 72, as well as the harmonics four. This is at a time delay of 3.3 milliseconds, though. That is a time delay that was stated by the LIGO collaboration, and so we've just been trying to look into the difference between that and the time delay cited in Miyash's paper and how the phase difference plays into that. So this would be that measure as well.
So they actually haven't stated the time delay. That's why we would have used it. We just got it informally from the person. But I mean, the paper just has 3 milliseconds, which could be consistent with 3.3 or 3.7. But yeah, so this is why we don't know exactly what time delay we use. But this is apparently the correct one, that according to if they use that, use their tool.
So different people give you different values?
No, it's just that the original paper didn't actually say what the number was. And there's no official LIGO thing that says what the number is.
Shouldn't be more accurate, like, computable from the position.
That's right. So that's what you should have. Well, yes, if you use the sort of position at the time, I guess, yeah, it should be publicly doable. And I guess other people have done it, and then there's 3.2 minutes. Because it was in no publication we could find at the time.
But shouldn't it be much more accurate than 3.3?
I don't think it matters if it's more. I mean, you can, it is more accurate, but it doesn't mean it is more accurate.
Are you sure? Because, I mean, that the tenth of a millisecond is kind of 10 kilohertz. That introduces a cutoff at 5 kilohertz.
Right, then LIGO doesn't see at 5 kilohertz. I mean, the noise.
They sample at 16 kilohertz, so you should.
But they do sample, but it's all noise. Yeah, so it's. I think anything beyond the kilohertz, there is not. I mean, I don't think anyone has seen anything.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, for example, the neutrino star merger signal, it is a border, I think, a few kilohertz, but then they haven't. I mean, if it was it's very loud, presumably they're going to see it. But yeah. No, I mean, it is true. If you want to see things at high frequency, you do care about it. But at least the signals that we've been looking at are really as high frequency, just because noise should stop.
Does this match the distance between the detectors divided by the speed of light, or is it different than that?
Well, it depends on where it is, because if it is just behind one of the detectors, then that would be the right answer. But of course, if it's coming from a different direction, then it depends on the direction. So it's something that's very computable if you know the timer detection and the position. So it's anybody who taken, I guess, astronomy. What course would that be?
Astrometry.
Yeah.
It's like ephemeral. You can. Find your way around it.
Exactly. If you have all your astronomical conventions, in principle, an undergraduate student do it. But yeah, I was too old. Okay, so that's why you better is doing.
So there's that measure, and then we're also looking at this one, which I believe is independent of time delay as far as we've reasoned. And then you can see the spikes in that one too as well. So at this point, so we can also see there's difference. There appears to be a little bit of difference in significance over time, but that is going to be something that we.
What are you planning in the? What are you planning in the?
Yes.
Okay, so this is just a zoomed in version of this. So this is all three echo measures over time fixed at 72 hertz. So the blue one being the original measure that Jad and Niyash used, the red being the Y measure, so the cross correlation with the autocorrelations, and then the green being the third measure.
So the point is they all have fixed at 1 second. The question is, but they're not necessarily at the same signal. It's on the right. Did it tell this one more significant?
It looks. The problem is that it could be that the X is more significant, just to have this amplitude difference that we would have.
Right, my mass is normalized.
Yeah.
Is probably that would happen.
But yeah, so then the next steps would be to figure out the significance of each measure and then optimize over that and continue to explore the phase difference and sort of find the probability of each measure of the signal. Thank you.
Questions, Professor?
With this time delayed, you find, did you manage to get how compact the object should be, where the affected boundary condition would be?
I'm not sure. I think that would have to be a question for
but the problem with binary neutron star is that we don't know the mass of the black hole that forms. So if we knew exactly the mass and the spin of the black hole that forms, then that would be... then we could tell based on, because this F echo 72 hertz, that would be related to the compactness. So now there's a degeneracy. I think this is Guy trying to connect. So there's really a degeneracy between basically the mass you think has formed, the spin of the object that you think has formed.
Oh, but you can get that just for time delay, right?
We can just get a time delay. Right, but then that tells us about the compactness depends on the mass of the spin and the compact. So there's a combination of mass and spin and compact that gives you this effect or the frequency of something. So if you, and the main uncertainty is the spin, which you have no idea, but it's the remnant black hole. The mass is, I think there is some range that I guess people expect. The spin is something else. Okay.
Yes, and 72 hertz plus or minus what?
What's the error on 72 hertz?
Oh, I did not have that written down, but I can bring it up.
Yeah, I mean, our resolution was 1 hertz, so. Yeah, I mean, you can see this the peak is at, I mean, one of the frequencies that it. Could be narrower than 1 hertz, just to have it sort of.
Yeah.
But can you say that it couldn't be 70 hertz?
Yeah. Yeah, plus or minus 0.5. That's a good question, I don't know. Do you have a plot of that? If you go to, if you just look at the frequency part, you're just looking at, yeah, this one. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it looks very sharp. I think it's just at one frequency.
How do you read, so I'm actually glad you stopped here. How do you read this picture? What are we looking at? That's right. I can't read the axes. This frequency across the bottom.
This frequency, and then this is this x that measure of basically the how strong the echoes are.
And so all of the ones, and what's the blue band?
Blue band is the theoretical prior given the mass and the spin of the binary, the black hole that you think is formed, given the expected range of mass.
And the spikes that are kind of have numbers on them, like 2 to 3, 1 to 2.
So these are the harmonics. So the ratios, the harmonics, I believe.
So the idea is that you're looking for something that repeats, but of course, if you have something that's repeating with the resonance of that frequency, you're going to see that as well. So that's why if you see a spike at one point, we're going to see all the resonance of that spike as well. So that's why you see most of these are resonances of the one to one spike. That's what. So basically, because you're looking for repeating signals, right?
Right.
But the thing is that because if something is repeating, it would be also repeating with some rational number times that.
Right.
So that's why you see multiple spikes that are associated with the same signal.
I see. So the way you read that is that if I look at more than 3 sigma, what you like about it is that the 4 things that cut that 4, that 3 sigma thing, they are in simple integer ratios.
That's right. Yeah.
And what are the different lengths here?
So in terms of horizontal or?
No, the red and the yellow.
Oh. The red, I believe, is the signal, whereas the yellow is taken at a random time to compare sort of the noise against the signal. We can see that the spikes that that we see in the harmonics aren't necessarily random.
They are larger than the random noise that you have.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know that time is man? Built an hour.
It's a conspiracy theory.
Okay. No other questions? Let's thank Red Dragon.